Today's Fretboard Journal podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. Retrofret is one of my favorite vintage guitar stores in the entire world because they keep getting amazingly cool vintage guitars, banjos, mandolins, and more. Right now, they have a 1934 Gibson L10. This is the all-black, kind of poor man's 16-inch Gibson L5. It has the picture frame inlays that came off the Gibson banjo line. I love this guitar. I actually used to own a black Gibson L10, which I think about all the time. I miss it very dearly. These are amazing guitars. They also have a 57 Stratotone doublet. That is kind of the two-pickup version of the Harmony Stratotone with the neck through and everything. You'll be sounding like Blake Mills in no time. Go to retrofret.com to see their entire inventory. If you're anywhere near New York City, you should go to their new Carroll Gardens showroom too. And as always, Retrofret does incredible restoration and repair work, as well as selling some of the coolest guitars around. If you do reach out to them, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. This is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. Today, I'm talking to my dear friend, Adam Buchwald of Circle Strings Guitars. We talk about Circle Strings, but Adam also has a brand new project that we talk about a lot, which is a whole new imprint called Iris Guitars. He's making an LG 00 kind of acoustic guitar for just $2,000, I wanted to talk to him about that, hear how he does it, because I don't know too many luthiers who are doing that well, and that seems like a pretty low price point to be starting with, so I wanted to hear all about it. We also get Jamie Muehlhausen, our mutual friend, on the horn. Jamie is a graphic designer. He's worked for Tony Hawk for years. He's done some work for the Fretboard Journal in the past, and he got the honors of making the logo for a brand new guitar model, as well as the website and all sorts of other branding stuff, so whether you're coming at this as a perhaps guitar purchaser, collector, who wants to hear about this new budget line of luthier-built guitars, or maybe you're a luthier looking for a little inspiration, I think there'll be something in it for you in this conversation. I know I had a great time talking to Adam and learned a ton. Speaking of luthery, yours truly built a Telecaster body last week, and I got to get dirty. I got to make some sawdust. I built a basswood, don't laugh, don't roll your eyes, all you Telecaster nerds. I built a basswood Telecaster body last Wednesday. I got the opportunity to be in a workshop full of tools, and mistakes were made. I may have drilled through the body once trying to make the little control cavity. And some of the pickup cavities look like maybe a beaver was involved, but there was no beaver involved. And now I've got this Telecaster body. I probably couldn't get $5 for it on Craigslist, but it's all mine. It's my pride and joy. And I feel a little bit like I just made a steering wheel, and now I'm buying all the parts at full price to build the car around the steering wheel. But that's okay. That's what happens. This is how you get the bug. I've spent way too many hours on the Telecaster forum reading about aftermarket necks and pickups, and I thought these days were past me, but they're not, apparently, because I'm going in full bore, and I will be hopefully playing a Telecaster in a month or two. I am getting help assembling it. I'm not stupid, and some of the final drilling will be done by a friend of the Fretboard Journal who I trust, who does these things for a living. What else can I tell you? In other electric guitar news, the Fretboard Journal's first ever electric guitar annual is out now. It is mailing to everybody who pre-ordered it. I know in this day and age of Amazon, where you order your dog food and then it comes 12 hours later, everybody wants it immediately. These go out, sad to say, periodicals class in the USPS, so it can take about 10 to 14 days to get to everybody. I'm sorry, you'll have it soon enough, and then you get to keep it for the rest of your life. But it is on its way to everybody. If you haven't secured your copy and want to, you can do so at fretboardjournal.com. And that's really the best way to do it, because we're not sending it to a ton of stores. We're not sending it to all the guitar stores that get the regular Fretboard Journal, just because we pre-sold a lot, which is great. And we hate waste, and we hate sending them and having to pay for postage and then them sitting on shelves and stuff. So the best way to get them is to directly order them from us. Michael James Adams edited this issue for us, which was a lot of fun for me to not wear the editor hat for once. And it's a great issue. If you like the Fretboard Journal and you love electric guitars, you're going to love this thing. The Fretboard Journal's 43rd issue, our next numbered issue, is going to be mailing out towards the end of October. It is an incredible issue as well. And there's some electric content in there. So it's not like we're totally separating the two out. But that is available. If you have not subscribed to the Fretboard Journal yet, you can do so ever at fretboardjournal.com. And we now have a 1, 2, and 3 year option. In the US, it's 3 years for $99 because a lot of folks wanted to do that so they didn't have to get renewal notices every year. So we are offering that right now. And if you use the coupon code podcast, you will save $5 off of your order. In other news, we've been shooting a ton of videos. Scott just got back from the IBMA, the big bluegrass festival in Raleigh, North Carolina. So we're going to have about a half dozen videos from there on fretboardjournal.com and our YouTube channel soon, plus a lot more. I'm going to be interviewing David Wilcox soon for this podcast. There's a lot going on. It's pretty damn busy, but I'm glad you guys are tuning in to what we are about. As always, if you like the Fretboard Journal podcast, we would love it if you would leave us a review over on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from, because it definitely helps us expand our audience. All right, one more plug for our friends over at Lee Valley. They are sponsoring this podcast as well. I used some Lee Valley tools while working on this Telecaster that I was telling you about. I used a chisel. I don't know how. I was a little scared of it. It's really sharp. But Lee Valley, for years, has been providing woodworking tools for artisans around the world. And they've been asked for a long time to make tools for luthiers and to carry tools for luthiers. And now they finally do. Everything you need, from the initial cutting of the body all the way to finish work. And they are a great company. I'm glad they are sponsoring the Fretboard Journal podcast. You can go to leevalley.com to see their full line of tools and home equipment. And right now, they gave us a couple of coupons for $25 off. And I'm going to give one away at random to somebody who emails us at fretboardjournal@gmail.com with the subject line Lee Valley. They are a great company. If you are at all a woodworker or a luthier, I encourage you to check out what they are all about, because they have some great stuff. And without further ado, speaking of great stuff, I'm going to talk to Adam right now about Circle Strings and Iris guitars. Adam, thank you for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's my pleasure to be here.
Is this sort of the, I know your town sort of, or not your town, but is this Fresh Grass Weekend coming up?
This is Fresh Grass Weekend in North Adams, Massachusetts at Mass MoCA.
Yeah.
Which is a great, great museum they have there. And they put on a great acoustic music festival from Friday through Sunday.
And you tend to have a fairly big part in this festival, if I remember correctly. I'm assuming you do again this week?
Yes. Ever since about 4 years ago, I actually have a lot to thank to you, because you introduced me to the people that put it on, and they have a luthier's tent there. And every year they have a bunch of local guitar makers and instrument makers, mandolins and violins and banjos and whatnot, display. And I've gotten to know them pretty well. And this is our fourth year back. And we do really well every year. We sell guitars, we take orders, and it's a good crowd. And for the past 3 years, we've been donating a guitar each year to raffle off to help the foundation that puts on the festival, which has band contests and instrument contests, you know, banjo, fiddle, guitar contests and whatnot. And we help raise money to give to the winners of those contests.
Nice.
Which is a nice thing to do. And we get great exposure from them. And it's just a fun weekend, and I get to meet a lot of the players, because the guitar is, you know, handed off to a bunch of the players there, and also people that visit the festival all see the guitar and get to know me, which is a great thing.
Yeah, it is a very cool festival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great because it's not just music. You can see the artwork and installations in these huge buildings they have there.
Yeah, Yeah, that was my favorite part.
It's always
part.
Nice to break it up.
Yeah, for sure. So before you started out, or before Circle Strings, your guitar company started, where did you start out making guitars? Nobody I know ever sets out from high school to become a guitar maker. I'm assuming your path is no different.
No, I had no idea that this would be my life. I studied music at University of Vermont up here in Burlington. And after college, I wanted to play music. And so I moved back to New York City. I'm from a little north of the city in Westchester County.
Okay.
And I moved to New York and to help me finance my life in the city, I started working for my father, who owned a metal stamping and tool and die factory, which was my grandfather's business as well. And I grew up working in that factory and on the machines and on vacations, sitting at a press and stamping metal all day, which I think everybody in the world should have a job like that at one point, just to see how the other half lives.
Well, it sounds very old world. You're not that old of a guy. Was this sort of a dinosaur even when you were growing up?
Kind of. I mean, the business did really... My grandfather had it in the, I think, the 50s, started in the mid-50s or early 60s.
Okay.
And it did really well then, and it did really well through like, the early 90s. But I guess the mid-90s happened, and then 2001 happened, and the whole manufacturing side of things in northern Westchester County and where we were just kind of died down, and we just couldn't compete with the China and India and overseas manufacturing. And it was pretty old world. I mean, the guys making the tools and all the dies for the stamping materials were either from Germany or Italy, a lot older than, they're probably in their 60s and 70s, and just knew how to make any tool or die to make any part, which was pretty amazing for a young kid to see. Throughout working there, I saw, precision work and learned how to work on these machines to make these parts. And one day I just thought, maybe I'll make an instrument, because I had all this stuff there. So I made myself a mandolin.
What was a typical day in the life? Like what kind of stuff were you actually making or stamping?
The majority of the work was different electrical contacts.
Okay.
For different lighting fixtures or, fuse boxes or furniture hardware. I can remember as a kid the majority of the stuff they made was stuff for shoehorns and shoe trees and sponge mops and different brackets for furniture building and whatnot. But I can remember going in there and seeing, millions of shoehorns. You remember those? And
of course.
Those little metal things you would help get your shoes on. And we used to stamp them for all the major department stores. So, JCPenney and Macy's and whatnot, they'd order, tons of those with their name stamped in them, and they gave them out with every pair of shoe that you bought. So I can remember doing that. And the sponge mops in the 80s when those came out, that were, they had the spring-loaded action and you squeezed them and got the water out of the sponge. That was a huge part that we made back then.
Dang.
And just like when I started working there after college in 2000, a lot of that stuff has went overseas, but we were still doing, majority of the work was mostly electrical contacts and different pieces of copper and brass for electrical fittings. But right after 2001 happened, a lot of the business turned to government contracts, making body armor or you know, landmine stuff and missile parts. And I had kind of a midlife crisis in my, I guess, early 20s, and woke up one night when my wife was pregnant with our first child and said, I'm going to leave the family business. I'm going to do guitars.
Yeah. And
I can remember walking into my dad's office the next day and telling him that. And it was just to see the look on his face, like, it was kind of a blessing and a curse, because I think he saw that the business was not what it used to be. And to succeed in it was going to be very difficult for me if I did want to take it over. And I think he was kind of happy to get out of it too. So luckily, he kept it for another few years, but then sold it and retired.
Got it. And you pursued the lucrative life of a luthier.
Oh yeah. Big money right here.
Yeah.
So luckily I was living in Brooklyn at the time and in a great bluegrass band with a repair guy named Bob Jones, who was, he was the repair guy at Blumenov's shop for a long time and then started his own shop. And he kept saying, no, 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 you can't work here. I don't have time for this and blah, blah, blah. But I showed him, I built a banjo and a mandolin and a guitar at my dad's factory. And I showed him what I could do. So he said, fine, you can come Fridays and sit and watch me, because I can't, if people are giving me their guitars, I can't let somebody else work on them. So every Friday for a year, I would go and just watch him do repairs and soak up the knowledge. And then it got to a point where he would give me, you know, crappy jobs like taking apart a banjo and cleaning all the hardware or cleaning, you know, crusty fretboards and stuff that it was a waste of time for him to do. And it got to a point where I said, look, I want to work on guitars. What if I get, you know, my friend's guitars to work on and bring them here? And he said, sure, but I don't want to have any responsibility. You could say you're doing the work, but in my shop, and I'll be next to you if you did need help, which was, you know, great for my confidence, because I knew he was there if I did need him for something. So luckily, being in the music scene in Brooklyn and New York City, there was tons of guitar players that heard I was doing it and started giving me stuff to repair. And luckily, the phone rang, you know, about a week before Christmas time, New Year's that year, at Bob's shop, and the shop retrofit needed a repair guy because their guy left. And Bob, you know, recommended me, and that was that. And I went and interviewed, and they gave me the job, and that's where it all started.
Wow. And at this point, you have a kid, yeah, right?
Yeah, I had a 1-year-old.
Are you doing the like half stay-at-home dad, half luthier thing?
No, I was working like 3 or 4 jobs. I was working at the retrofret. I was still doing all the bookkeeping for my dad's business. And actually my wife's company, she's got the real job. She does commercial real estate research for a firm in New York and handles all the client service department there.
Okay.
But at the time it was just a startup business and they needed a bookkeeper. So they hired me to do all the bookkeeping for them. So I was doing and playing gigs and teaching music. So I was doing as much as I needed to do to get some money in the bank.
Nice. So you go to work for Retrofret, who I have to mention sponsor this podcast, but that's not why I'm talking to you. And my picture in my head of, you know, I have yet to go to the new location. They just moved a week ago, but, you know, it's a very rare guitar store that seems like they get, you know, everything cool imaginable. It's not just about pre-war Martins. They get weird banjos and theremins and all sorts of stuff. How did you get started there, and what did they trust you with?
It's a funny thing to ask. I have to mention the interview process. I walked in. It was probably, I don't know, after the workday, 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And the place was just like buzzing with enthusiasm because at that time they had Lefty Frizzell's Bigsby guitar.
Of course they did.
that they had to sell. And it was just such an exciting time. And for me to like go there and have an interview with just so much energy in the air was so thrilling, you know, being so new at this trade. It was so exciting to just be a part of it. So they handed me that guitar, and that was the first guitar I touched in the store, let alone being the first time in that store. And it was thrilling to play it and to hold it and just to check it out. You know, it's such a legendary instrument. So they handed me that, and they just watched me look at it, and then they took it away, and then they had a whole collection of classical guitars from the Augustine family.
Okay.
So they had, you know, Torres and you know, you name it was in that collection. And they handed me each of those guitars and had me look at them and watch that, you know, and evaluate them and look at them. And without seeing any work I've ever done or knowing what I could do, they said, "We like how you look at the guitars. You got the job." So I was, you know, I went home, and it was, you know, vacation time or whatnot around Christmas time and New Year's. And I was so excited to, after the new year, I was going to go start and work there. And I get into work on January 2nd, and there's an old Gibson A style mandolin, one of the white top ones,
yeah,
that needed A3. A refret.
Yeah.
Yep. So that was my first job, was to refret one of those. And from there, I mean, you know, every day you just never knew what was going to walk in that door to be fixed. And, you know, the majority of stuff we were doing back then was buying instruments that needed work, and we would fix them and sell them. So it was a lot of pressure right from the beginning. And I think that helped with my focus and my dedication to the craft, which is great.
It's probably the only store in the country where you could work for years and not have to do like a neck reset on an Ovation or clean up a BC
Exactly,
Rich.
Yeah. Yeah, that stuff just did not come to the shop. It was just all tool stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I worked on anything like that ever at that shop.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, and then a Martin came in, and then a Gibson came in, and then a Yasco Colossus banjo, and then, you know, a Wilkanowski archtop to, you know, it was just incredible the stuff that would come through that door.
So how many years were you there?
I was there for, I think, about two, three years.
Okay.
And I shared a shop there with a guy named Jason Petty, who was a great lute maker. And he did a little repair work there, but somehow they just let him work in that workshop and build lutes, because he did some work on classicals and lutes that they would sell or violins. But he was a great inspiration to my work and helped me a lot when I first started to build there. So part of the deal with the job there was that I could get my own repair work through the door and do it. But they also let me build when I had time, and they had a whole wood shop downstairs and a spray room. And so I built my first few, guitars working there, you know, having access to all these old vintage guitars, which was a heaven sent.
Yeah. And what were those initial guitars? I'm always curious, coming from the world of repair, where you've seen like the last 100 years of fretted instrument history. Like, what was in your head? What did you want to make?
I just wanted to make anything that played music. You know, I knew I was still young at it and very much a beginner. So I like the first guitar I made was a Dreadnought. So, and a friend played that guitar. So actually, the second guitar I made was a Triple O, because a friend played the Dreadnought, but he was a classical guitar player, so he wanted something a little smaller. So I thought maybe a Triple O 12 fret might be good. And then the third guitar was a Dreadnought for another local musician. So I think like the first 10 guitars were probably just Dreadnoughts, Triple O's, or like a Gibson 00 copies. But ever since the beginning, I've loved the traditional look of those old guitars and have tried to keep it that way.
Yeah. And then what got you out of retrofret?
Basically, the having a child in New York City was not what I wanted to do with my life. And I wanted to get back to Vermont somehow, always, after college. And luckily, I got a call from this guy named George Morris at Vermont Instruments, which was a guitar-making school in Thetford, Vermont. And so he asked me if I wanted the business. And I said, maybe we should be partners for a while and see how it works out. We took the risk and moved up north. And luckily, my wife's boss said, you can work remotely and come down here once in a while, because they loved her so much. So that was another bonus, and not too much of a risk moving out of state with a child. So we moved up, and I taught guitar making there for about 3 or 4 years and built a few of my own instruments while working there. And that was a great learning experience, just to work with beginners and teach them how to make instruments from scratch and learning how to fix their mistakes.
You bet.
Because there were a lot of them.
Sure.
Yeah, and from there, after a few years doing that, it became clear that me and him couldn't work together anymore for many reasons that I don't want to get into right now. But luckily I met Michael Millard of Froggy Bottom, and he gave me a job building guitars with them for the next few years.
What was that like?
Which was an amazing. That was incredible. Just to walk into that world after never really seeing a shop like that function or work, it was just a great kick in the ass about how those guitars, the quality of those, you know, what goes into those guitars, how much work it entails.
And at what stage, Michael, in addition to another sponsor taking our last page of a magazine, he's kind of moved around a little bit and had different shop configurations. Sometimes everything's made where he is. Sometimes it's made remotely. Where were you at in this process?
I worked in his shop when he had a shop in Chelsea, Vermont.
Okay.
And then one of the other guys, Eric Goodenough, had a shop in Brookfield, Vermont. So I would go wherever I was needed that day. So pretty much every night before the work day, I would check in and be like, where should I be? There were so many different shops.
You're on call.
Which was amazing that a guitar shop can function like that, but they can do it.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And, they were finished in another shop, and then they came back to another shop and were strung up. So Michael Millard, he knows so much about making the guitar that you want. You know, just to sit there and listen to him talk on the phone with a potential client about what kind of guitar and sound they went after was priceless.
Sure. I can only imagine. And then from there, did you kind of hang your own shingle and start Circle Strings?
Yeah, so Andy Mueller, who was building at Froggy Bottom,
yeah,
he left, and that's when I went and started working with him. And he was a school teacher for a while, but then decided to come back, and the business just couldn't handle, you know, paying that much money to employees, so it was time to go, and we decided to move up to Burlington, because that time we were in central Vermont. So we moved to Burlington, and then I opened my own shop and started doing a lot of repair work up here and building my own line of guitars.
Nice.
That was in 2012.
All right, so we're 6 years into this. I've seen mm-hmm. your guitars. There's one that lives very near to me here in Seattle. They're exceptional. I know you're doing a ton of, you actually have like a repair team now, right?
Yeah, I do. Cat Fox, who was out in Seattle, moved to Vermont with Rick Davis of Running Dog Guitars. And they live in the islands a little north of Burlington. And she approached me about doing some repair work. And it was a great thing because I needed help, especially on the repairs, you know, and I just wasn't in the mood to train somebody to do that. So she knows what she's doing and does a great job, and a lot more work has been coming in. So it's been nice to have her around.
I bet. And are you, go ahead.
Anybody in Seattle needs repair work.
Send it to Vermont.
Send it to Kat. Send it to Vermont.
Well, there has been a bit of a black hole in this town since she left, because I used to just tell people to send their guitars to her, and now I don't know who to send them to. So
that's what I hear.
And are you still sharing a shop with Creston Lee?
Yeah, Creston. My old shop was in my garage at my house, and I had a huge legal battle with my neighbor about me working in my garage. And after a few years of dealing with her shenanigans, we just decided to move. And luckily at that time, Preston was in the market to buy a commercial building in Burlington and asked me if I wanted to rent half of it. So it was the perfect timing. So that was about 4 years ago now. And Sarah Ryan, who paints Creston's guitars with those beautiful floral designs and whatnot, she was in the building when we first moved into it, but she moved out about a year and a half ago.
So you've got like a little guitar commune going.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing building just to have, you know, because we don't compete at all. We help each other out with certain things and do work for each other in certain ways. And, you know, each have our own businesses, so we don't have to, you know, worry about, you know, being each other's employees or whatnot. And it's a great relationship. And I thank my stars every day that he got this building and I'm able to rent half of it from him, because it's definitely exposed my brand and my work to a lot of his customers, which, you know, you can't ask for anything more.
Yeah.
And he makes an amazing guitar. We all know that.
Yeah. So a week ago, less than a week ago, you kind of dropped some news on everybody. You started a second guitar company, Iris. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. About, I don't know, the past year we've been toying with this idea to try and make a production model guitar that uses the same wood, same materials, same specs, same everything. Because most of the guitars from Circle Strings were all custom ordered spec to the player. And I've always wanted to make a bunch of the same instrument just for my own exploration of sound and what the woods and are actually doing, and to make seven of the same guitar with the same exact material and have them all sound completely different was a great experiment and showed me that there's a lot more to making guitars than the materials you pick. And basically we wanted to make a guitar and keep the price at $2,000, because our guitars were now over $4,000 and we're approaching a market that is highly competitive and not, a lot of musicians couldn't get into because of how much money they were. So, you know, we liked what Collins did with Waterloo and other brands do with other lower end, I don't want to say lower end lines, but less expensive lines, to try and differentiate from the other line. So it's been an exciting week because we're showing these guitars to a lot of people and getting great feedback, and they're going to be released into the public this weekend at Fresh Grass.
Now, how do you go about making a guitar that has all the same woods as your fancy guitars come in at that price point?
Well, they're not as fancy woods as they are on the other guitars.
Sure.
You know, a lot of the mahogany doesn't match color-wise, so they're stained to match. The source for the spruce is Carpathian spruce, which is a lot cheaper than other material I can get for, you know, like red spruce or different European spruces or Sitka spruces. So, I mean, luckily I found a huge batch of wood that I was able to get at a price that would fulfill this, you know, price point. And we're not doing as many, there's no inlay in the guitar, so it's a silk screen on the headstock. It's plastic binding, where we usually do wooden binding. The case is a soft shell, you know, polyfoam case. The tuning machines are, you know, the Stahtite, Grover Stahtite tuners. So they're a lot less expensive than the Waverleys. The fretboard and bridge material is Catalache, which is a Mexican hardwood. And that's priced a lot less expensive than different ebonies and rosewoods and can be shipped anywhere. But I'd say one of the biggest things in the process that we are saving money on is the finish, because we're just doing a light seal coat and then stain it, and then no pore filling, and we're just doing a satin finish on there without much sanding and buffing. So, I mean, that cuts a lot of the labor down. And the guitars, because of that, are sounding great because there's not much finish on them.
Interesting. I can't say I've seen a guitar. What does a guitar without pore filler look like? Do you just kind of feel it a little bit different?
Yeah, it's not, you know, glossy smooth, and you can see the pores in the wood, and you can feel them a little bit if you rub your fingers across the back. But, you know, I'd say it'd be a big deal if you could feel it really bad on the necks, but you really can't with the satin finish. It feels great.
Interesting. And one body size for this guitar?
Yeah, we chose a kind of a shrunken down slope shoulder dreadnought to the size of a 00 or an LG. It resembles an LG a lot, but the curves are a little different than that guitar. And we're doing it a little wider in the lower bout. The depth is a little larger than a Gibson. And it's a 14 fret guitar with a 25 inch scale, which is very comfortable for most players and can be finger picked and flat picked very well.
And, you know, what's your overall kind of sales strategy with these? Are you going to just make a batch of whatever you want to make and hope it finds a customer, or do customers get any input at all?
I think initially, you know, our goal with releasing this is we just made this batch and we want to show them off and show what we got, and ideally just keep making them the same way, to keep the price down and list them on the website and on Reverb and whatnot for sale, and see where it happens. 'Cause if, you know, of course I'd love to get them to dealers, but that adds another huge cost to this guitar, and I just don't know if it's something that we can afford to do right now. Whereas, you know, if we can directly sell them to customers, you know, giving them an approval time of a few days if they buy them, And if they don't like them, ship them back. And because it's not a crazy glossy finish, we really don't have to worry about if it gets, you know, a little blemish or scratched or something, because most people can't really tell anything's wrong with the finish if that happens because of how it's done.
Very cool.
So I think the marketing aspect of it is going to be organic, and we're just going to, you know, show them this weekend. And like I said, there's a lot of people that go and check out guitars there. So I think it'll be a good place to start and see what people think.
Sure. And speaking of marketing, should we try to get our mutual friend Jamie Muehlhausen on the line?
Sure. Let me give him a phone call right now. Yeah, and Jamie's a great graphic designer out in California that I met at the Fretboard Summit.
Nice.
When I was in San Diego.
Nice.
So it's amazing what you guys have done for me. Introduced me to the Fresh Grass people and then to Jamie. So
we
thank
try
you again.
No problem.
So yeah, we met out there and struck up a friendship. And when I had this idea for the line, he was the first guy I thought of for doing the headstock logo and all the graphic work and website, because I think that has a lot to do with marketing this new brand of guitar. You know, the actual look and feel of everything.
Totally.
So let me get him on the phone.
This is Jamie.
Hey, Jamie, how are you?
Jamie, you here?
I'm here, yeah. Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Wow, I actually did it.
Nice work. Thank you, Apple.
Yeah, thank you. Did they have their conference yet today about the...
I think it's happening
today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, I just spent a half hour talking to Adam about his whole history and leading up to the Iris guitar thing. You are a graphic designer. You've done some work for us, which we've loved. It must be the most fun thing in the world when, as a guitarist, when somebody says, like, hey, help me make my new guitar line a reality.
Yeah, it's kind of a dream come true, really. I mean, I've done... You know, like you said, I've done some stuff for you guys, and I've done stuff for some other guitar people in the past, and little stuff here and there. But to have someone say, hey, I'm getting ready to launch a new line of guitars, and I want you to design the logo that's going to go on the headstock, and especially coming from somebody like Adam, who I respect so much, it's just like, holy cow, that's a dream job, you know? And so I'm pretty excited about the whole thing for sure.
What kind of, I know what kind of back and forth process there is for the stuff I've hired you to do. What's it look like making a logo for a guitar? I'm curious, like what did Adam have feedback wise? What were his initial visions? And then how much back and forth went on?
You know, I mean, Adam was pretty open to kind of just having me throw some ideas at him for the most part. I think at one point we kind of decided that we wanted some sort of a little symbol that represented an iris, you know, whether it was literal or kind of more graphic, which is kind of what we ended up with. But, you know, we kind of went back and forth a little bit and looked at a lot of old headstocks over the years. And I think I found a couple of Pinterest pages that were pretty amazing that had just like hundreds of old headstocks from different things. And so, that's kind of where, you know, the initial idea for what we ended up with kind of came from, just some of the different things that we saw online, and I threw stuff back and forth at him, and he had a lot of input back and said, oh, I like this or that. And let's, you know, what if we merge these two together or whatever kind of a thing. So it was a really cool collaboration to be able to kind of come up with what we did.
Nice.
And I think the best part about it for me was knowing Jamie's style, and I loved it, and it was a, you know, pleasure that he was so enthusiastic to work on it. But knowing that this logo or these symbols were not going to be inlaid or have to be cut out or done in a way where it would make too much work for our side, where we knew it would be a rub-on transfer. that we could do something that was, you know, a little more difficult and more bold and exciting and kind of in your face. And I came up with the peghead design, and I sent it to him, and he sent me samples back and forth, and then he came up with what he had, and I'd never seen anything like that. So it was amazing to watch somebody at his level come up with something different, because we all know making a peghead look different these days is pretty hard. Everything's a little, that's new is a little too extreme for my taste and my look on the guitars. And for him to come up with something that was simple and elegant and modern and, you know, looked traditionally like a guitar peghead was pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I'd throw in too that, you know, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with it for sure, but you know, how many times have we just seen like the name of the guitar company or the maker's name and script, you know, across the top of the headstock. And so, you know, I think we were looking for something a little different that stood out. And I know for me, and I don't even know if I ever really, you know, said this much to Adam, but you know, I've always been a big fan of like the old, like the Martin D45, and D41s that come down the middle of the headstock, and the old Craftsman,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, the old department store brand, had a lot of their guitars that had that kind of a thing that came down the middle. And so that was sort of a little bit of an inspiration for me to kind of, you know, it's not that nobody does that kind of thing in the past, but not very much. Usually it's a little more traditional and I don't think this is like super avant-garde or anything weird like that, but it's still fairly traditional, but it just comes from a little bit of a different angle. So I was pretty stoked when Adam said he liked that one.
Nice. And I know you also worked on the Iris Guitars website, Jamie. I know a fair amount about you. I don't know if anyone, that many folks listening to this, but you know, you came from the world of skateboarding. You used to work, or you still do work for Tony Hawk. And I'm just curious, you know, that universe seems like it's just bustling on the marketing front. And, you know, kids are buying T-shirts left and right because they want to support their company. The guitar business is a little more staid, a little slower. I don't know if you have an answer for this, but I'm just curious, what advice would you give guitar makers in general, not just Adam, about like how to sell their products to more people, having come from this kind of much bigger industry?
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny because, like, I come from skateboarding and snowboarding, surfing kind of world. I've worked for Tony for many, many years. And you know, the one thing that I really see that people in our industry do really well is the social media aspect of stuff. They jumped on stuff really early with social media and built up a big fan base. And it's not easy to just immediately build up a giant fan base of people necessarily for your company, but you can kind of slowly build it and develop this thing that people kind of want to buy into and be a part of. And so, you know, I'd recommend that as, you know, for today's kind of marketing, and that's free. I mean, that's as long as you're willing to take the time to kind of create your content and do stuff on a regular basis and kind of buy into what you're all about as far as your company goes and what you want to project out to the world. I think you can kind of build on that. And there's a lot of people in the guitar industry that I think do a really good job of that and have created like a pretty cool online force. Websites are a great source of information for people that are now interested in your product for sure, and want to go see what the models of your guitar are, or how to buy something, or, you know, purchase your T-shirts and that kind of stuff. But your website's not going to suck anybody into your company necessarily from the get-go, because people aren't really there. They're not, you know, looking at websites the way they were 15 years ago, where that was the point of entry for people. Now it's Instagram and Facebook, and increasingly Instagram more than anything else, I think. I kind of feel like Twitter has sort of become more like if you're a famous celebrity or a sports star or, those types of things, or a company that wants to just put out corporate information to stockholders or something, Twitter works great. And a lot of people follow that and see what people say and that kind of stuff. But if you're, you know, Iris Guitars, you're not going to build a Twitter following necessarily. So it's all about visuals and stuff anyway, and getting people to really love your guitars and what you're doing. So Instagram seems to be the place to build your platform, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Adam, have you sold any guitars through Instagram? Yeah, that was great. Adam, have you sold any guitars through Instagram?
Not the Iris model, but the Circle Strings models I have. There have been a couple of times I've posted a guitar for sale and people have snatched it up, you know, without ever seeing my guitars or been to my website. There's a couple of people that have contacted me through, you know, the messaging on Instagram about potential builds and it's worked out, and I've sold a couple of used guitars that I've made for other clients via Instagram. So it's been a great thing for me to learn how to use that to showcase what we do here, because there's only so much time I have putting stuff on my website and not knowing if people are looking at it or getting any feedback from people on what they think of the work. So it's nice to meet new people, you know, see old friends or colleagues on the work they do, and see what we're doing here, you know, being able to show it that way.
Definitely.
And like for the, just to have, you know, a graphic that is clean and simple and that I can show off the brand, you know, basically we're building a brand here above anything else. And I mean, I know the guitars are great and they work great and they look great and they sound great, but I want to develop a you know, like Jamie said, something that somebody wants to be a part of and support in that way.
For sure. Well, and you share a roof with Creston, who has to be one of the greatest guys at making his customers feel like they're part of a community. So,
yeah, he's done an amazing job marketing his brand, and it's definitely an inspiration working next to somebody who's so good at that. You know, he's got such a look to his design and his style that it's, you know, like I said, it's amazing to work next to somebody like that so I can, you know, feed off his stuff as well.
Definitely. Well, guys, congratulations on this. This is exciting news. The website is, what is the website URL?
It's irisguitarcompany.com.
All right.
And the Instagram is irisguitar. And at Iris Guitar, and the Facebook. I just started that this week, but I haven't really putting that much energy into that yet. You know, I wanted to get the website up and the Instagram up this week before Fresh Dress, just so we have that there to showcase. But yeah, we're on Facebook. Check out the website. You know, check out Circle Strings. We're all over all that. And thanks for doing this. It means a lot to me.
No problem. Thanks, guys, for talking. This was fun.